Okay, so we get the general picture, and you can obviously play the full entirety, should you so choose, in your own time. But if we actually try and tie in what we were discussing last week in terms of the angry young man, how did we actually get from the notion of concern about American influences in Britain to literally a war which, as we'll see as I talk through the session today, really opened up a whole new era in terms of aspects. It's often felt that the experiences that America went through in Vietnam, the war which, according to their generals, was the first war that was actually lost on television via journalists and so on, were kind of preceded and prefaced the experience that the Soviet Union actually had in the 1980s when they also were involved with Afghanistan. So let's try and actually start unpicking some of the key things here. And a reminder that last week we were talking about the angry young men and their rejection, or at least overt rejection, of American influences. The arguments that Richard Hoggart, Kingsley Amis, and so on were actually putting was that American consumer culture was undermining traditional British values. This ideology, if you like, of buying things to buy more things, to be happy, to then buy more things and so on, was seen as something which was intrinsically vulgar at best and downright anti-British at worst from that point of view. And this notion that British culture and identity would disappear was very much being raised at the time at the university level, academic level and so on, under this pressure of not just American consumerism, but also throwaway culture. Areas that kind of really impact in terms of how we work with things. And yet, actually, you could argue that those so-called angry young men, the likes of John Osborne and so on, were just as much influenced by American culture, and they were just as much the products of American influence, as the young people in the coffee bars, obviously sponsored by Coca-Cola, etc., that they would actually frequent and criticise. It's a kind of unusual level of, I suppose, mild hypocrisy. So what's happening with respect to some of the global scientific aspects here? Well, the social sciences had actually come to the fore in the United States in the 1930s. And by social sciences, I'm referring to economics, psychology, sociology, and political science, as opposed to natural science, physics, chemistry, mathematics, and so on. The social science, primarily through research and statistics, seems to actually be a way of providing valuable information for politicians who primarily were keen on avoiding the worst economic and social effects of the Great Depression. If you've ever read any of the work of John Steinbeck in Grapes of Wrath or of Mice and Men, well, you've seen the sort of the impact that the Depression actually had, specifically in the United States, the kind of fallout from the Wall Street collapse. This society, which had been predicated on the notion that year in, year out, growth would continue to improve, would continue to get better and better and better, and suddenly there's a major financial crash, kind of echoed in this century by, obviously, the banking crisis of the noughties and so on. But there was still a major concern. And there was still this notion that, well, if you can use science to figure out technology, if you can actually use the technology to generate the Industrial Revolution, why can't you apply science to quantify human experience, etc., and actually look at ways in which we can start understanding how things work? In other words, if you can find out how society works, then you can actually change it. You can change society by making minor adjustments. You can manipulate. You can nudge people in the kind of direction that you want to go. It's a kind of offshoot, obviously, of public relations. The elements in which you're changing the sort of things, marketing, advertising, and so on. You can begin to apply scientific methodologies to predict items, to control outcomes. You can actually start viewing society itself as a machine. And a machine can be fixed. If it goes wrong, if it breaks down, you can fix that machine. So experts and politicians can actually come into play by saying you adjust this, you change that, and things will work through. It's when you're looking at the FTSE index, the application of theory to kind of ensure that things work much more for the benefit of all rather than for the benefit of the few. So this notion that science, social science in particular, and public policy would actually deal with planning, would actually result in change, and change which would also result in everything becoming okay. It would be change for the better. Now, from the 1930s, private companies, obviously aware of this in the United States, were beginning to employ psychologists to check workers' morale. This is very much in the aftermath of industrialization. Fordism, producing cars, mass production, factory lineups. You can have any color as long as it's black, doing the same thing, repetitive tasks, again and again and again. You clock in, you do your work, you clock out, and so on. But obviously companies were also keen on looking at time and motion studies. They were wanting to actually test characters, see what kind of psychometrics would be involved, things which, again, we still see today in terms of how do you actually recruit the best people for your particular posts and so on, and how you would actually get the best results, how you could organise your workers, perhaps even more significantly, how you could start controlling them and also the products that they produce. So you start building that into place, you start applying aspects. And needless to say, from a sociological point of view, again, they proved to be quite successful. They started talking about how you can make more fridges, make more white goods, make more products, develop more other things. Certainly the ideas eventually did cross the Atlantic, as most things are prone to do. And by the 1950s, of course, in the advent of World War II, British demands for new university courses, with a greater number of middle-class students, as we know, entering higher education for the first time, learning new skills and training, and a need to actually expand in terms of the housing market, the growth of new houses, roads, quantity surveying, and so on, really actually opened up the opportunity for those social sciences to come into place in British universities. So jobs in planning, in adult education, in public policy, in social services, all helped to create a new generation of young British graduates in the 1950s and 1960s who would read Kingsley Amis, they would listen to jazz, they'd go to the cinema, they'd watch new wave films, and they'd all actually be connected happily together. They'd also watch American movies and would work through that whole process. By the beginning again of the 20th century and the middle of the 20th century, it's fair to say that American industry was thriving. Factories would be pouring out goods. The stock market would soar. Credit was very easy to come by. Companies would promote new goods through advertising campaigns using all of the techniques that they learnt in war propaganda. If you compare the techniques that are used to generate people going to war and build on that and apply them into advertising, they do have success. It's a kind of tried and trusted way. It's how advertising actually works. If you're also adding on the notion of labour-saving and luxury goods hitting the main streets, things like telephones, vacuum cleaners, washing machines, cars, you're again restoring a society which is very much designed to produce stuff and make things on a regular basis. And if you add to that the notion of that way of life of consumerism is not only developed by advertising campaigns, but also the whole product of Hollywood, American films carrying images of the American way of life, certainly that also opens up the whole notion of the ideal middle class across the globe. And middle Americans would primarily consider their standard of living a right. The right to liberty, the right to happiness, and the right to consume. But not necessarily for everyone, as we've said. And just taking a look at this very iconic image, world's hand of standard of living, yes. There's no way like the American way, fine. An all-white family there. And of course, perhaps for the less enfranchised, the disenfranchised, etc., yet another cue, yet another issue, and so on and so forth. The centre of the corporate world, partly as a result of the social sciences in the 1930s, but certainly by the 1950s and 1960s, had switched very much to Madison Avenue. It used to be Wall Street, the financial industry, but as I said, 1929, that collapsed. By the time you get to the 1950s and 60s, certainly the whole era of Mad Men, a self-coined phrase, apart from the TV series, which was used to describe men living and working in the advertising industry on Madison Avenue, you actually really worked on the premise of having a democratic capitalism with fairer distribution, in which everybody could have a home, a fridge, a car, and so on. And if you've got all that stuff, you're obviously going to be happier. This would also feed into building material companies, the construction industry, appliance manufacturing, the whole aspect of the American dream, which if you look at magazines of the time like Life, Better Homes and Gardens and so on, again, that image that's coming through of the ideal is being pursued and so on. The ideal family would be sold in the ideal home with happy parents and happy children. Family life was very much the ultimate aspiration, 2.4 children. You know, obviously, heterosexual relationship, but with your television, your patio, your barbecue, your family vacations, your car, your appliances, your fashion, your neighbourhoods, your heating, all would all fit into that. And energy was very, very cheap. You know, fuel was effectively the equivalent of pennies or cents in the American sort of system. Now, certainly by the end of the World Wars, and as we saw with respect to the Suez Canal crisis in Lecture 1, the Middle East was also putting up oil prices. And because of the Cold War and that ideological battle with the Soviet Union, America was spending so much on defence that her debts were pretty enormous. And so that actually feeds in to this need to export capitalism, to make more money, to sell more stuff. Because that model of democratic consumption, again, possibly the least worst model of democracy, it's arguable, we'll talk about that in the discussion period, that argument to export American goods to the rest of the world if the American economy was not to collapse was very much to the fore. And by the 1950s, this influx of American ideas and American goods was beginning to change the look of Britain. Coffee bars, as we've seen, Coca-Cola. Remember that slide that we actually had of Coca-Cola being used to suckle the globe and the teat, etc. Rot people's teeth across the globe, etc. Jukeboxes, American music, American films and fashion would all flood the market. These are all products you can sell and sell quickly and make money from. Again, as we said, critics would argue that American culture was destroying British culture. People were watching American films, they were listening to American music, they were watching American TV shows on the new commercial radio TV channels, and they were losing touch with their own past and their own identity. Now, again, this might be seen as an extreme viewpoint, the notion that American values were destroying British values, although if you compare it with respect to the French reluctance to accept McDonald's, or indeed various Asian countries who feel that one more golden arch is just one too many, maybe you're seeing a similar argument developed in terms of how you're exporting that product overseas. This notion that purchasing happiness by buying a new fridge is perhaps selling a pipe dream. Whether you actually need to actually look for a new fashion instead of looking for deeper personal happiness is, again, open to huge debate. And ultimately, you could say it's making people shallow, it's making them dissatisfied. Could you honestly say that the right to consume is what we're here for after several billion years of evolution? Maybe life should be about slightly more than that. As we said, the American dream was to export capitalism and democratic consumerism to the rest of the world. One big global market. And they were genuinely of this belief, and still are. I mean, this is again at the heart of the whole system. And I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong, but there is the belief that the American way is the best way, it's the best type of society, and giving others the right to participate in the American way of life is the only way forward. National health be damned, or whatever. So if America is going to prosper on that model, clearly Europe and Asia need to be on board. Why? So that you can develop global markets. If nobody's buying your product internationally, and let's face it, with the collapse of the British Empire, you have some markets that are actually there to sell things to, then you've got a problem. But there's another fly in the ointment, and it's this. Not everyone accepts the American model. The Soviet Union, obviously under Joseph Stalin, former ally in the Second World War, believes quite passionately, following through obviously Lenin and the Russian Revolution and Karl Marx and so on, that actually consumerism and capitalism is not the sole way in which human beings can and should actually exist. And their socioeconomic model, again, you're coming out of that social sciences and the notion of how we're developing things, is communism. Now, communists primarily believed, arguably still believe, that production should be owned and controlled entirely by the state. Part of the challenge, of course, in enforcing a system in which everybody is equal is, as George Orwell stated in Animal Farm, some animals are more equal than others. You automatically get people who are in control who are not equal at all, and they've got a completely different viewpoint of life and so on and so forth. But they still ultimately believe the notion that society should be classless. You shouldn't have such notions as selling to the middle, lower or upper classes, because those things don't exist. They're illusionary. You shouldn't actually worry about land and so on, because again, there should be a common ownership that's actually there. Society basically should be working on a model that wasn't just based on consumption, what people thought they wanted to buy, it was what they actually needed, what they actually needed to take away from the whole thing. Again, you could argue, again, that's something which is being echoed in terms of the extinction agenda and a variety of other things, so there are lots of issues to sort of consult with respect to this. As well as, obviously, some of the practical facts that historically were part of this whole mix as well. Because after the Second World War, not Russia, because it's important to separate that, but the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, actually occupied most of Eastern Europe. In addition to that, China had also had a communist revolution, and Mao Zedong had taken over the leadership of China as well, similar kind of areas. And just like Americans, communists also wanted a world that was modelled on their own system. As you can see, I mean, without going too much into the semiotics of this 1960 image, the title, The Red Iceberg. The thing about icebergs is that the majority of the iceberg is underneath the ocean. It's underneath the water. Here we have Uncle Sam, obviously an iconic representation of America, the good old US of A. And here we have a range of countries who are basically tombstones. They are dead to the model. North Korea, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, not the Czech Republic, Slovakia, just Czechoslovakia, China, Hungary, Poland, and so on and so forth. You're not going to sell American goods to those countries. They're not going to let you pass the border. End of. Problem. So we have this situation, the hammer and sickle, the communist ideology, they now of course have the atom bomb as well, versus the good old US of A, an ideological Cold War. The problem is, you can't go to war, because otherwise you do have a genuine mad situation. You have mutually assured destruction. One side starts hurling nuclear bombs, the other side responds before you know it, the whole planet has fatally been destroyed. So nuclear technology clearly makes the whole notion of traditional warfare obsolete, and some might say, thank goodness for that. But that's not good enough. There's still a battle going on. And the battle that emerges is what we see as an ideological war. A war in which saber-rattling and propaganda takes centre stage. You can't fight a war directly, but you can actually get involved in what would be referred to as proxy wars. You can get other people, just like proxy voters, to go to battle on your behalf. The first example of this, before we come to Vietnam, was actually the Korean War between 1950 and 1953. There were 2 million civilian casualties and nearly 500,000 casualties amongst the Allies in the South, including the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada and Australia. In North Korea, there were apparently 1.5 million casualties, which also included Chinese troops and Soviet advisers, because they couldn't be involved directly with the war, so they would be giving advisors and encouraging things from that point of view. But as you might expect, historically the figures and the data for that is somewhat vague, so many might still be missing from that point of view. And during the 1950s and 60s, as you can see from films and television shows and the spy series of the time, etc., the Cold War, because it hasn't heated up obviously, has become a way of life. You have the East versus the West, quite literally manifested by the Iron Curtain, which obviously sort of led to the building of the Berlin Wall in the 1960s and so on. You had communism versus capitalism. And somewhere in betwixt that, you got Britain trying to survive, trying to actually work its way through the system, as indeed are a large number of other countries. Now, the main arenas for ideological and military intervention were, as we mentioned, Korea, which the North and South battle was one sort of aspect until it became, we reached the sort of stage of an armistice. But also areas which we would now refer to as the Third World. Areas which had previously been looked after by European empires, like the French Empire, like the British Empire, and so on. But those European empires were crumbling, as we saw last week. And there was a genuine fear that if you've got a vacuum, nature abhors a vacuum, so those countries which were formerly looked after by countries sympathetic to the United States would actually fall under the Soviets. And the Soviets would actually take over. And one of those colonies was the French colony of Indochina. Indochina. That equivalent range of countries was Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. During the Second World War, the Chinese had actually occupied Indochina. Sorry, the Japanese had occupied Indochina. Apologies. By the time the Japanese left at the end of the Second World War, they basically left again a vacuum, and a revolutionary movement sprung up in Vietnam with the aim primarily of saying, we've already got rid of the French pre-World War II, we've now got rid of the Japanese at the end of the Second World War, we're not going to basically hang around whilst we're taking over again. So effectively, we are effectively setting up a government in Vietnam with the aim of ending colonial control and seeking a new way of life for the population. Great, you might say. But the problem is, the French haven't quite given up their interests in Vietnam. And they basically say, we'd like to look after Vietnam again and come back in and take over the whole system. And the United States would say, yes, that's a great idea. We'll back you. Why does the United States decide in the mid-50s to back the French in taking over Vietnam when, of course, they had nothing to do with the British in terms of Suez? Well, quite simply, they were very scared. They were scared of something that they called the domino effect. Because if, having had a communist revolution in China, which led to North Korea actually going communist, if you've got another absence of power in Vietnam, then you have a situation that if one country falls to communism, then slowly Vietnam would go, then Laos, then Cambodia, then Thailand, then Malaysia, Indonesia, Burma, India, the whole thing would collapse. Not only have you lost the market there, basically you've lost huge areas of territory to an ideology which fundamentally is completely opposed to what you're trying to develop. And interestingly enough, of course, Indochina, Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia, is also very rich in mineral products like rice, rubber, iron ore and coal. All essential things to actually work through the process. It's also the gateway to markets and commodities in Southeast Asia. So if you lost, for instance, Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia, and possibly Thailand, you lose your access to a huge area of the planet to sell stuff to, etc. In other words, your interests as a country are seriously being threatened. Again, it's that sort of line that's used with respect to the Gulf War and so on. I mean, the oft-stated line was, why was it that we actually had a major problem with respect to Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, in Africa, in the sort of 90s and so on, and yet no country was interested in actually going in? Well, maybe they didn't have any oil. You know, Saddam Hussein, on the other hand, Iran, maybe there's a lot of oil there. Maybe there's a reason for that whole system. Nevertheless, back to the 50s and 60s. America at this stage, again, we're looking to approach a change of presidency, was funneling in billions of dollars just to support the French, just to actually support their attempts to actually retake Vietnam. And even when the French effectively pulled out, they introduced and installed, obviously with the work of the Central Intelligence Agency, Committee for Overseas Affairs with respect to America, their own particular puppet government in Saigon. That was so unpopular that we had a whole range of responses, including the somewhat disturbing picture of a Buddhist monk actually setting fire to himself, self-immolation from that point of view. And there's also a big challenge in terms of what we're seeing here. Diem, D-I-E-M, was the name of the person who was actually installed as the leader of South Vietnam. Ho Chi Minh at this stage had taken over as a communist leader in North Vietnam. We hear a tale of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, etc. You can see an image of him on the right-hand side there. Diem was also a Catholic, and he was a Catholic in a country which predominantly was Buddhist. He was also somebody who was very much in favour of the landlords, not the peasants. And anybody who dared to criticise Diem, who had been installed primarily with the help of the CIA, was basically imprisoned. So you're not really generating a lot of popularity for the perspective of Diem, etc. Communists in the north of Vietnam were grouping around Hanoi as the centre of the government, led by Ho Chi Minh, as I mentioned. And in 1960, rebels in the south, under American control at this stage, formed the National Liberation Front, better known as the Viet Cong. Also in 1960, we get a new American president. Not Richard Nixon, who'd been unsuccessful in his bids to actually take over the presidency, but John F. Kennedy, as we know, this new, bright, positive things. And Kennedy's expressed position was that he supported both Diem, the leader, and American involvement in the Vietnam or Indochina region. So what have we got here? Well, we've got a situation where North Vietnam and the Viet Cong in South Vietnam are effectively seen as taking on the greatest military superpower in the world. This is the equivalent to having the likes of a Lincoln City going toe-to-toe with Barcelona and Real Madrid on the same sort of pitch. It's not going to happen. It'd be a disaster. Maybe even Lincoln United, actually. Lincoln City, obviously, still sort of working through the process, etc. However, and it's important, however, from a national psychology point of view, the Vietnamese have had a long history of challenging occupation. As we mentioned, the Chinese, the French, the Japanese. Their notion of the little guy going up against the big guy has actually become part of the national cult. It's part of their national identity. Go on, let's have a go if you're hard enough, etc. And so Diem, the leader again, isn't coping with dissidents to his pro-America regime. And as we said, in June 1963, a few months before Kennedy's assassinated, we have this image of a Buddhist monk sitting down in the public square and setting fire to himself simply as a protest. And many others followed his example. Diem's response was to arrest people, to fire on protesters. Now, all of this, from a propaganda point of view, is bad publicity. It's bad PR if a country that you're supporting is suddenly basically taking fire on its own citizens and so on and so forth. In addition to that, the CIA, the external agency, Central Intelligence Agency, was working subversively in the country to support a military coup by the generals. There were actually, by this stage, in the early 1960s, about 17,000 unofficial, quote-unquote, CIA agents working in Vietnam. 17,000. Serious numbers. In the end, they decided that even though they were aware about a coup that was being set up by the generals, they didn't actually want to warn President Diem, despite the fact that he was phoning urgently asking for help and advice, and in the end he was found dead in the back of a truck. 3 weeks later, in November 1963, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Conspiracy? Well, that's another debate for another time. But that also led to the taking over in the United States of Lyndon B. Johnson. Lyndon B. Johnson was a Texas chap, but he was inexperienced. There was a sense he wasn't altogether in control of what was happening. And his defense secretary, Robert McNamara, was also new. But Robert McNamara was an educated social scientist. However, there's a wonderful image of Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara. Johnson on the left, McNamara on the right. And it's clearly a case of, what a flip. How are we supposed to cope with this? What is the situation? How do we develop with this problem of communist ideological warfare, which seems to be winning the case in Vietnam? The answer, in 1965, was to start a full-scale war in Vietnam. Not a nuclear war, but a full-scale war. And again, historically, the war is a disaster. By 1968, there were 500,000 American troops in Vietnam, all fighting in this fairly dirty guerrilla war. America actually dropped more bombs in Vietnam than both sides, both the Allies and the Nazis and the Japanese, had dropped in World War II. There were more bombs actually dropped in Vietnam during this period. They also spread chemicals to destroy forest cover. They used napalm, a fairly nasty substance, which is gasoline jelly that sticks and burns people alive, in terms of images that's actually there. They were not messing about with respect to this. And yet still, there was a problem. The American army would go after dissidents in search and destroy missions. Again, civilians who may or may not support this tendency of the Viet Cong to nationalism and so on would be taken away, they'd be killed, they'd be imported to refugee camps and so on and so forth. And actually, in Operation Phoenix, the CIA executed 20,000 civilians without any trial because they were suspected of communism. Unpalatable facts, but still provable in so many ways. As I say, Donald Trump, he's pathetic by these standards. This is serious stuff here. There's a history that's coming through this. In 1968, there was a detachment of Americans who were sent on a search and destroy mission to My Lai. They killed between 450 and 500 women, children and elderly, lining many people up in the ditch and shooting them. Basically, war was driving people crazy. As we saw that initial video from Paul Hardcastle online, you were getting troops who were being recruited to the army, they were drafted in there, and they were being put into situations for which palpably they were psychologically unsuited, and it was inappropriate, and adds to the fact that this is a jungle war in tropical conditions where the heat is constantly on and you've got a whole range of issues. This is not the simplistic approach of the American operations, even in Korea, let alone the Second World War. The war actually carried on until 1973, and it was a disaster in most senses. People would actually still say that we're kind of paying the price of this particular aspect. The total cost of the American Vietnam War, $100 billion. $100 billion. But perhaps even more importantly, it began to undermine America's self-belief. And although Vietnam has now gradually reinvented itself as a tourist centre and so on, it took an awfully long time to get to that stage. There were something like 58,000 Americans who were killed, whereas in terms of Vietnamese, there were 3 to 4 million killed. So I suppose on that score, maybe, you know, looking at numbers. Now, one of the key aspects about this war, which is critical when we consider journalism histories, is the fact that this war had a huge impact on ordinary Americans who were used to being on the winning side. And not just the winning side, but the side of the good guys. And night after night on television, they're seeing body bags coming home. They're watching the war unfold on television. This is not the American dream that they'd be promised in terms of the way of life where everybody will actually settle for consumerism because it's the best way forward. This is something where their children, their relatives, and other human beings are suffering hugely. Understandably, young men would increasingly refuse to register for the draft, or they've burnt their draft cards in protest. People would react to that, inevitably. In San Francisco, 300 returned their cards initially in an anti-government protest. But by mid-1968, there were 3,000 prosecutions of people who basically refused to be drafted and would either move to Canada, leave the country, or work through that. That also went from 3,000 to 34,000 by 1969. Why would you want to actually sign up for the draft, be flown off to Vietnam, possibly be shot, but end up having to shoot Vietnamese innocent citizens, and so on and so forth? It makes no sense whatsoever. Human beings should be better than that. And partly because of the media, partly because of the demonstrations, we're also seeing in 1967, again the Summer of Love, which we'll go on to consider post-Reading Week, huge demonstrations outside the Pentagon, the main military base within Washington, by anti-war protesters. there was the sense that actually gradually leaders such as Abby Hoffman, who was the co-founder of what we refer to as the Yippies, not the Hippies, the Yippies, the Youth International Party, would actually sort of address this whole thing. And even in this kind of very symbolic notion of putting flowers in the gun barrels of the army, putting that message from there, it's a peaceful attempt to actually come to grips with this dreadful, devastating war. And of course, this is a war that Britain at the time is being encouraged to support and be part of. It's one of the reasons why there are various tales of Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister in Britain, being accused of being a secret communist sympathiser, because unlike North Korea, he was not willing to commit British soldiers to war in Vietnam. Remember, the official recruitment for national service had come to an end in 1963. So it wasn't as though we had an instant number of young men who could be sent off to war to support this in any case. But there were lots of sort of cases of where these things are being developed and put together. Now, as I say, the protests started peacefully, but there was a whole situation of significant violence in the very near future. And it wasn't just students and social activists who would actually protest. I mean, there's Abby, the co-founder of the Youth International Party. But actually, this was something where you can't turn around and say it's just students or it's just layabout individuals who've got issues with respect to this. By early 1968, there were a large number of ordinary people at home who understandably were becoming very anxious. In celebrity terms, the boxer Muhammad Ali refused to actually serve. And as a result, the authorities actually took away his championship boxing title. War, in all senses of the word, was actually destroying belief in authority. Millions of young people were rejecting the values and behaviour of the elders, because again, 20 years after the end of the Second World War, here we have a situation which at any moment could escalate in terms of a proxy war, in which you're battling ideologically with traditional warfare, albeit with a few added bonuses like napalm and so on, into a nuclear conflict and conflagration. Certainly millions of students and young workers who were very much connected with the notion of the language, the behaviour of the time, etc., tended to sign up for the message of Timothy Leary, Harvard University scientist, social scientist, but also psychologist, who, when using lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD, coined the phrase, turn on, tune in, and drop out. Because running parallel to this, of course, you're getting a big musical revolution as well, which we'll come to again later on today and in subsequent weeks. By 1968, though, 5 years after President Kennedy's assassination, the whole foundations of American society seemed to be under attack. Things were going from bad to worst in Vietnam. And Martin Luther King, who was campaigning against poverty, was also assassinated. So was Robert Kennedy, leading to a huge outbreak of urban violence in the ghettos, which again was put down by soldiers. So you're seeing again a conflagration here, which at one level is suggesting maybe we're also seeing a revolution in the United States as well. From people like the non-whites, the women, the people who actually were suffering as part and parcel of the whole sort of sequence. And Robert Kennedy, as I mentioned, who was actually seeking the presidential nomination on an anti-war platform, was himself assassinated also in 1968. In August of that same year, thousands of anti-war demonstrators descended on Chicago for the Democrat convention. The city police assaulted marchers in what was later called a police riot, and hundreds were injured. So a lot of issues here, not a kind of exaggerated moral panic, but something which, as we see in terms of the revolutionary notion, also was being echoed in Paris, in France, in areas which had other reasons and rationales in terms of where things were going, how things were developing, etc. And so in 1969, in a somewhat fatigued general sigh of exhaustion, we get this phenomenon of popular culture which kind of crosses over the generations, called Woodstock. Woodstock is very much regarded as the first major counter-cultural festival. It actually became a national emergency when the roads were actually blocked and has become a legendary event that's kind of echoed the whole notion. All of those factors were kind of feeding into the decisions that the politicians were having to make at the time. By this stage, President Nixon had replaced Lyndon Johnson, and had been elected as President of the United States. And his decision, after the problems that we're having with respect to Vietnam, was there's no option. We've had problems with Vietnam. We're still having problems with Vietnam. What will we do? We'll invade Cambodia. So we'll back up to that routine. Now, this led on to the notion of riots, in particular at Kent State University in Ohio, where there was a peace protest against the Cambodian invasion, in which the National Guard would fire into the crowd, injuring 9, paralysing 1, and killing 4. And this very, again, equally iconic photograph in 1970 of Marianne Vecchio, who was actually 14-year-old at the time, kneeling over the dead body of Jeffrey Miller. Not good publicity. That's the minor thing you say. Not good publicity when these issues are being put out and churned on that basis. Now, a lot of the publicity there that was given to student protest would create the impression that the opposition middle class basically were saying, oh, these are just sort of middle class people, intellectuals, etc. But the fact of the matter is a lot of blue collar workers were very supportive as well. Why wouldn't they be? Why would they want to actually go off and support a war, etc.? In fact, by 1970, most polls suggested that 65% of American citizens were against the war in Vietnam. Well, it was pretty much ending in failure on every front, including mass body counts on either sides, etc. It was a scale of carnage that really had not been seen before. Desertions were occurring, there were thousands of desertions, etc. Even soldiers in Vietnam started wearing armbands and badges which supported the peace movement. All that low morale manifested itself in incidents such as fragging. Fragging, by the way, is when you actually roll a fragmentation bomb under the tent of a superior officer. So there was kind of rebellions within the troops as well, who weren't happy with what they were seeing and what was happening in terms of these 4 students and more who'd basically been shot by the National Guard. Why? Because they were protesting against involvement of war in Vietnam and so on. You might well say it was only 4 compared to the thousands of Vietnamese, etc., but significant in terms of icons and so on. And then from the Yippies, we also move into that other countercultural phenomenon, the hippies, that protest movement. However, there is a sense that actually those protesters were very much, again, another American phenomenon. But the attitudes and the fashions would also quickly spread to Europe. Now, by the late 60s, Vietnam, like everything American, had also followed that well-worn path and became an international issue. It bound together groups of protesters in many countries. It helped to spread countercultural ideas about racial equality, alleviating poverty, peace, sexual freedom, drugs, and music. And those are some of the things that I'll go on to talk about when we start talking again about how ideologically there was an impact in terms of protesting about the war in Vietnam, because this was something which very much was being reflected on a global stage when we start talking about how things are developed and so on, and the demands to work through that. Now, again, depending on your viewpoint, perspective, etc., you might say, isn't this just like a 60s version of Extinction Rebellion? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. There are sort of areas that come through with that. I want to end the lecture, though, with another excerpt from a fairly popular tune at the time, which maybe gives you some idea in terms of the kind of sense of apocalyptic anticipation that was actually mentioned within this. It was a one-hit wonder for Barry Maguire and entitled Eve of Destruction.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, why you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Understand what I'm trying to say. Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save. Will the world in a grave? Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me. Legislation and marches alone can't bring innovation when you